Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I stole Yoke's Thunder with a different pretty movie, I guess. Let's see. I'm going to rearrange. All right, so yeah, I mean, this is what I work on, right? I'm going to be talking today about dwarf galaxies, Milky Way mass, and smaller galaxies, really. And what we're looking at in this particular movie is, you know, hot gas exploding out of dwarf galaxies and galaxy winds. And it's just a temperature map. So the white is very hot, and then it turns to yellow, and the red is the coolest stuff. And I'll be talking a little bit today about what this does to galaxy properties as a function of mass up to about Milky Way mass. All right, so the question is, how many times this week can we see a version of this plot, all right, as motivation? Here is a dark matter halo mass function. Here is the observed stellar luminosity function. They don't match, right? So here we go again. This is often, right, this low end here below the knee. We tend to invoke supernova feedback to explain why these things don't match. Up here, we talk about AGN feedback. But of course, another way of looking at this is to plot the stellar mass to halo mass relation as a function of halo mass. And of course, galaxies like the Milky Way are the best at making stars, or the most efficient, I'd say. They're still not very good at it. And below Milky Way mass and above Milky Way mass, of course, they become less efficient at making stars. And the reason we're all here is we're trying to figure out why. And like I said, today I'll be focusing on this mass range and doing the thing where I again ignore the AGN feedback at this mass range. Okay. So that's one line of evidence that we've all been pointing towards for why we need feedback. I actually think there's another one that sits right under our noses all the time, which is the mass metallicity relationship. So what you're seeing here is work that I did in 2007, where I looked at the mass metallicity relationship for a bunch of simulated galaxies. And in red are the results at reg of zero. And the black line running through them here is the best fit from Tremonti et al. 2004 for more than 40,000 SDSS galaxies. The blue are data at simulations at reg of two. And this is data at reg of two from Don Erb. And I wanted to point out that this has been updated recently. Charlotte Christensen put a new mass metallicity relationship in her paper. And this is, you know, there's been a lot of progress in the feedback model in these simulations in the last 7 years. And interestingly, you still get simulated galaxies that lie right on this relationship. And so this is a point I kind of want to come back to. A lot of feedback models end up producing the same global relationships. But it is feedback that's driving this relationship. So if I take these models here and I turn off feedback, what happens is that all of the galaxies rapidly overcool, they go on, they form too many stars, and you end up with instead this basically flat mass metallicity relationship. And so rather than, you know, outflows may play some role in this, but the dominant process in setting this relation is really feedback, regulating star formation as a function of galaxy mass. Okay, so we've also known, of course, from simulations that this is necessary for a long time, because for years we ended up simulating disk galaxies that didn't look like disk galaxies, right? They had big spheroids sitting at the center and didn't have nice extended disks. This is an example from Jesus Zavala and collaborators, where they ran a galaxy with very little or no feedback, and you end up with a big bulge-dominated thing at the center. And here they've added stronger feedback, and you get a nice extended disk out and a much smaller bulge. Well, these days, that's not as much of a problem. Sizes of galaxies are pretty well coming out of the simulations. This is an example, again, from my work where I looked at the exponential disk scale length of galaxies as a function of their luminosity. The red are the simulations. The black are observational data. You can see they do a really nice job even of spanning the scatter in the relation as well. Well, it's not just sizes, right? These days, everybody matches everything, right? So I'm going to pick on this group for a minute, maybe because none of them happen to be sitting in the audience. But if you can read this, I don't know if you can read this in the back, right? So now people are producing these simulations, and they're writing papers that look like this, right? They match the stellar masses as a function of halo mass for a whole bunch of redshifts. They have reasonable star formation rates, the sizes are right, the gas fractions are right, the gas phase metallicities at a whole bunch of redshifts look good. The morphologies are good, the surface density profile is great, rotation curves look good too, right? So I'm picking on this group, but in fact I could list about four papers like this that came out last year. Right? So a whole bunch of simulators are now matching a whole bunch of global properties of galaxies, and yet we're all doing it with slightly different feedback models. Right? So how is this happening? Well, part of it is the feedback, right? So as we go, there's been a lot of progress in these simulations that you've seen this week. Part of that is computational, right? We're just getting to higher resolution. And as we've been going to higher resolution too, we've also found that we want to add as much energy as we can into these galaxies. So this is a cute plot that Fabio Gubernato made showing the amount of energy injected into these simulations as a function of time. All right, so, you know, Fabio particularly wanted to make this because he's been told for some reason that he has very strong feedback in his simulations, right? So he's trying to prove, no, I don't have strong feedback in my simulations. But you can see, you know, even now as we start to add young stellar feedback, right, before the supernova even go off, we're suddenly getting, you know, 300% of the allowed supernova energy being dumped back into the ISM in these galaxies. Really, you know, the interesting thing is as we've done this, right, as you add more energy, we're starting to get galaxies out that look more and more like the real thing, which is interesting to me. Okay. So having said that, I want to now talk a little bit about some of those global properties that come out of the simulations with this feedback. Okay. So the first thing I'm going to focus on is what outflows do. All right, so as, again, we go to this higher resolution, we start resolving the high-density peaks where star formation is happening, and then supernova go off in these very dense peaks, and we've started driving these outflows from galaxies, you know, just naturally. We don't have to put them in by hand anymore. We actually eject the gas from the galaxies. So this one in particular is a dwarf galaxy. It's sitting down here. It's edge-on. This is a temperature map of the gas in this galaxy. And this movie was just made at a time where there's been a burst of star formation, a bunch of supernova energy has been deposited into the galaxy. And you can see that it's, you know, hot bubble forms, it expands, it hits the edge of the disk, and it creates these flows perpendicular to the disk. And the black line here is the Vero radius of this galaxy at this redshift. So, you know, it's not just some little galactic fountain, right? There is some of that happening, but in general, there's a lot of gas that also just leaves the galaxy. It escapes the Vero radius, and it does not necessarily come back. Okay. So one of the things that those outflows do is it changes the bulge properties in the simulations. And this is good because for years, simulators have been forming galaxies with unrealistically large bulges compared to what we actually see in the real universe. And this is the extreme case of that, right? Forming bulgeless disk galaxies. Here is data from Van den Bosch et al., where the gray hashed lines in each one of these panels is the angular momentum distribution for some bulgeless disk galaxies in the local volume. And so this is the cold gas and stars, the angular momentum in the cold gas and stars. And the black line that is the same in each one of these panels is what you would actually expect for a typical cold dark matter halo. And what you should take away from this is that in every case, there's this tail of low angular momentum material that is predicted and not seen. Okay, well, in that dwarf that I just showed you with the outflows in that movie, I can make the same plot, and it looks like this. Here's the cold gas and the stars, and the purple dashed line here is the angular momentum distribution of the dark matter halo that that dwarf is sitting in. And so you can see, just like the observations, it's missing this tail of low angular momentum gas. And the reason that's happened is because the low angular momentum material has been blown out, right? In those winds, naturally, more star formation is happening at the center, and that's where the low angular momentum material is sitting, and so it's naturally driving this low angular momentum material out of the galaxy. And the nice thing about these SPH simulations is that you can prove that, right? You can find the gas that left the galaxy and ask what was its angular momentum before it got kicked out of the galaxy, and then you get this red line. So the gas and dark matter initially do start off with the same angular momentum distribution, which is good because that means tidal torque theory works, which we like. And this galaxy does end up being bulgeless. This was actually the first ever simulated bulgeless disk galaxy. Right, but it's not just bulgeless disks. This has an effect on galaxies as a function of galaxy mass. So here is a galaxy that is about 10 times more massive than that dwarf I just showed you. It still ends up having a bulge, right? So I should have actually put a picture of it here. It does have a small bulge. But Charlotte Christensen looked at what happened to this one galaxy basically as a function of ISM, right? So here you can see in the dashed line is what she called a primordial ISM model. So this just has hydrogen and helium cooling in the gas down to 10 to the 4 Kelvin. And then on top of that, you can add metal line cooling. And here's what happens to the rotation curve of that galaxy when you add metal line cooling. This thing ends up being way too bulge dominated, right? All this stuff now ends up in the center and stays there. Then she added on top of that, primordial plus metal line cooling, a prescription for H2, right? So she actually tracks the formation and destruction of H2 and has stars form in the H2 gas. Well, the real change that happens here with the H2 is the outflows. And so that's what this plot is looking at. For the same galaxy, the amount of outflows, the ejected material in each one of these models. So as you go to higher, as you go to the H2, what happens is that your ISM is allowed to cool further, become colder, more dense, more clumpy. And then when supernovae go off in those clumps, they have a very strong effect. They become massively overpressurized, and they eject a whole bunch of material. So in the end, this clumpy ISM is what gives you more outflows and leads to a smaller central distribution in these galaxies. Okay. And I wanted to show this plot because this question came up on Monday, and I don't know if it ever really got answered, but it was asked, you know, if you're blowing stuff out of the galaxies, where is it? Well, here's my answer to that in these simulations as a function of the maximum circular velocity in the simulations. The red points here are what would be observed in these simulated galaxies. So it is the cold gas plus the stellar mass, okay? And so you can see if I tried to observe these, which are roughly Milky Way mass, it would look like they've got 30 to 40% of their initial baryon fraction. In reality, if I count all of the gas in the halo out to the Vero radius, it's actually more like over 90% is still sitting there. Much of it does not escape the halo. But as I go down to these lower mass galaxies, say VC of about 30, it's going to look like you've lost 98 or 99% of your baryons. And in fact, you've actually lost 90, right? So there's a nice trend as a function of mass. As you go down, you really do lose more of your baryons from the halo. And the interesting thing to me, at least, is that these low mass galaxies here at 30 kilometers per second, right? This is the gas fraction in those galaxies. So cold gas, again, this is just observable now. I'm looking at cold gas, I'm ignoring the hot gas in the red points. So it's the cold gas fraction over the total cold plus stellar fraction. And you can see that even though some of these have lost, you know, 90% of their baryons, they're still very gas rich. If you saw them, if you observed them, they would look like they've had, you know, they've got 80 to 90% of their baryons in H1. And that's because the gas that does stay behind is so inefficient at turning into stars, right? And again, that's feedback regulated. As feedback goes off in these shallow potential wells, it's very effective. And now the intriguing, just wanted to raise this point. I think this is quite intriguing. You can see there's quite a bit of scatter here at these low galaxy, at this low galaxy end in terms of the H1 fraction. But this is a fairly tight trend over here in terms of baryon content as a function of halo mass. And that plays directly into the baryonic Tully-Fisher relationship. So if I plot, again, the cold gas and stars in these galaxies as a function of their circular velocity, you can see in red the simulations have an incredibly tight trend, right? And this is in blue data from Stacy McGough, which also shows a very tight trend. I'm not quite sure what to make of this. First of all, I have to wonder if this is real. Should galaxies look this tight, right? Should there actually be scatter in this relation? When Stacy did this, he was very careful about removing galaxies that looked in any way disturbed, right? So that in the end you had a very tight relation out. Well, maybe that's telling you that any scatter in the relation does come from external processes. You know, but I have to wonder, should galaxies have this tight a trend as a function of halo mass in the amount of baryons that they retain, or should there actually be scatter in this model? Okay. So one other thing that we actually haven't heard about all week that feedback does is it pushes the dark matter around inside galaxies. Right, so this is what I've been mostly interested in over the last couple of years. This is that same dwarf galaxy that I showed you earlier that had the outflows. As this comes back around to high redshift, you'll see that the dark matter density profile in this galaxy is initially quite steep, right? It's cuspy, it's consistent with an NFW profile. And with time, you can see that it starts to flatten. And at redshift zero, this thing has a dark matter density core. So if you are not like me and are surrounded by the cusp core problem every day, I'll just remind you what the cusp core problem is. Right? So if I run any dark matter only simulation, it doesn't matter if it's a dwarf galaxy, a Milky Way mass galaxy, a cluster, if I measure the dark matter slope at the center of that galaxy, I always find that it's very steeply rising towards the center, or cuspy. Now, this is a nice prediction of the cold dark matter galaxy formation theory, so we can go out and we can test this, and when we look at the rotation curves, particularly of dwarf galaxies, we find that instead the density distribution seems to be certainly much more shallow than predicted by an NFW profile, and oftentimes, sometimes completely flat or cored. So the fact that you can make dark matter cores with feedback is a good thing, right? It actually solves this cusp core problem. And what I'm showing you here is observational data from the THING survey, the H1 Nearby Galaxy survey, where they've been getting, you know, detailed rotation curves, measuring the density slopes in the inner parts of these dwarf galaxies. The gray lines here are what you would expect if they all had NFW profiles. And you can see that basically the THING's galaxies do not have cuspy profiles, right? They have an average slope of about minus 0.3 instead of 1. This would be about 1 up here. On top of this plot are two simulated dwarf galaxies as well. In yellow and green here are two simulated dwarfs roughly in the mass range of the THING survey, and you can see they also do not have NFW profiles. These have actually been analyzed just like the THING's galaxies. We sent them fake H1 data and fake photometric maps, and they have derived a similar slope to the overall survey. So if you're wondering how this happens, right, this slide is meant to give you a sense of how this happens. This is the same dwarf galaxy I've sort of been showing you over and over. And now we're looking at it face on, and it's at high redshift here. We just picked this to show you an example of what happens after a burst of star formation occurs in this galaxy, and it creates a hot bubble of supernova gas. Right, so this is a density map, this is a hot bubble of gas, winds would be coming out of that hole, you know, out of the screen towards you. And the key here is that at these very high redshifts, the gas densities and the dark matter densities at the very center of this halo are comparable. Okay, so when this hot bubble gets created, it wants to expand. It does. It expands rapidly. It actually expands faster than the dynamical time at the center of this halo. And so as it expands, it actually flattens the potential well of that galaxy. Right, so as the potential well flattens, the dark matter really has no choice. The orbits have to follow the potential well. They expand. Right, and this gas can later cool back to the center and go on and form more stars. But you just keep doing this over and over again. You push more and more dark matter out of the center of your galaxy with every burst of star formation. And this is a test showing this happening on a test particle here. You can see this one that starts off at about 10 parsecs. Given the star formation history of this galaxy, it gets pushed out to roughly just under about a kiloparsec over the history of this of shown here. But you can see that a particle that starts off at 1 kiloparsec actually does not feel this potential well fluctuation. So it stays where it forms, basically. So it's really, in the end, you end up creating roughly kiloparsec-sized cores in these galaxies through this process. So we're not the only ones. Right? Here's a whole list of people who have used feedback to explain dark matter core creation in galaxies. I particularly love this plot from Ramon's paper because of the very, very fine time step resolution here. So you can see the bursty nature of the star formation, but you can also see the reaction in the density slope, right? So as this thing starts off cuspy, you can see that at some times when the gas cools back to the center, it does become more contracted. The slope becomes initially a little bit steeper, and then there's a burst of star formation, it becomes shallower, and it does this over and over, but the overall net result is actually to end up forming a core in this galaxy. And Dushan was kind enough to provide some slides from the fire simulation. So this is his student TK Chan, who's working on looking at the cores in the fire simulations as well, where they're measuring the density slopes between 1% and 2% of Arvir. And so you can see that in the smallest dwarfs, those are quite concentrated. You end up with quite a steep slope here at 1 to 2 Arvir. But as you go up to higher halo masses, you end up with things that have very flat dark matter density cores. Now, as you go then towards higher halo masses, about Milky Way mass, you again find a steepening of the profile. Right? So the Milky Way mass potential becomes deep enough that this effect, the feedback has a hard time counteracting this effect. And you end up maintaining cuspy profiles in Milky Way mass galaxies. We also see this effect in our simulations. So again, here is the dark matter density slope now measured in a different way. It's measured formally at 500 parsecs in these galaxies. But you can see that this is the black line you would expect for an NFW profile. These dwarf galaxies still stay pretty cuspy, but as you get above about 10 to the 7 in stellar mass here, you start making these cores in these galaxies, and that corresponds to roughly about 10 to the 10 in halo mass. This plot has been updated, and I just wanted to show you this because it's been updated to add a couple more massive galaxies towards the Milky Way. And just like in the fire simulations, you can see that these galaxies start to roll over and become steeper again as you approach Milky Way mass. The same thing was seen by Arianna DiCincio and her collaborators. So they have come up with this nice plot that shows as a function of halo mass, or a function of the stellar mass to halo mass relation, the dark matter density slope in these galaxies, again measured between 1 and 2 Arvir. And you can see just like the other plots I just showed you, these dwarfs are the most efficient at making cores, but as we go to these higher mass galaxies, Milky Way mass, things again become steep or cuspy. So now I just wanted to turn to some open questions, one of which is what happens at higher masses? This is data from Drew Newman, where he and his collaborators looked at the dark matter density slope in brightest cluster galaxies. Right, so this is not an easy thing to do. They are quite baryon dominated. So they have tried to subtract off the contribution from the baryons and get at the dark matter slope underneath. And the interesting thing here is that overall, they find a dark matter slope in these brightest cluster galaxies of about a half, so much more shallow than NFW. And the interesting thing here to me is the core size, right? So some of these are consistent with a couple of kiloparsecs. Some of these look like they have 10 or 50 kiloparsec size cores, dark matter cores in these galaxies. Now, we don't simulate clusters at the same resolution, right, that we simulate all these dwarf galaxies, right? We can't do it. It's too computationally expensive. But I can already tell you that even if you ran one of these with supernova feedback, you wouldn't get a 10 kiloparsec core, right? You can't do this with supernovae. You can't fluctuate the potential of the galaxy with supernovae over 10 kiloparsec scales. So the question is, can AGN do it, right? I think Ramon had a paper saying AGN had a similar effect in fluctuating the galaxy potential wells. So any process that fluctuates potential wells should be able to give you dark matter cores. The question is, can AGN do it on 10 to 50 kiloparsec scales? And I'm kind of doubtful that they can. Right, so this is a really interesting open question. If it's not feedback, if it can't be explained by AGN or supernova feedback, what could give you these big cores, and then you have to start wondering whether or not you have to, start modifying the dark matter model, and that's what some people are thinking about to answer this question. And the final point I wanted to make was that all of this, right, these days, all of this is motivated, or sorry, everything that we do is to try to match this relation, right? The stellar mass to the halo mass relation. It was pointed out to us a few years ago that we were failing to match this relation. We were all forming way too many stars in the simulations. And these days, that's like the first goal. So here are the simulations that I use. The stellar mass to halo mass relation of the simulations is shown here in black, and the green is the abundance matching results for most or at all. This is the same thing for Ariana and her collaborators, where again they're comparing to Moser et al. And they're finding that they can match the stellar mass to halo mass relationship. Phil showed us that the fire simulations also did this, right? So this is now as a function of redshift, even all the way back to redshift 6, where there's really no data to constrain this. But it looks pretty good as a function of halo mass, right? So this looks promising, but I worry about it for a couple of reasons. Okay, so the first reason is this one. All right, so one thing also that feedback can do is it can change your halo mass. I mean, it doesn't really change your halo mass. What it comes down to is how you define your virial mass, right? And commonly what people are doing is they're using a fixed overdensity of 200, right? Times the background density or critical density of the universe. If you then, say, go down to these dwarf galaxies and blow out 90% of your baryons, if you're trying to fit to the same overdensity, your virial radius shrinks, okay? So this is a plot that Munshi made showing the virial mass in an SPH run, a baryonic run that had feedback, blowout, compared to the very same halos, exact same halos, run in dark matter only. And you can see that basically the virial mass in these and the SPH runs is 70 to 80% of what you would get in the dark matter only run. So these types of things might need to be considered when you're doing abundance matching. And I was having breakfast with Yop today, who pointed out another thing you need to consider when doing this. I hadn't read Archive in 2 days, but 2 days ago there was a paper out by Tulsiwala and collaborators looking at a new stellar mass to halo mass relation in dwarf galaxies. And what they did is they used local group simulations and noted that right about here, below about a few times 10 to the 9, you start having dark halos. Right, reionization or some process of affecting these halos so that they actually become dark. So if you try to do abundance matching these halos, you are going to fail. Right, the luminosity function is no longer a nice extrapolation. Right? So this is again the black line is the Moser et al. Relation. If I, if I back up a few slides, you'll see that a bunch of us are matching this Moser relation down to very low stellar masses. And maybe that's a sign that we still don't understand star formation in these dwarf galaxies. All right. This suggests to me that galaxy formation at low masses is stochastic, right? And that's something that we really don't understand. Why are dwarf galaxies, why is this a stochastic process? I saw those nice trends in the Tully-Fisher relationship all the way down to these small dwarf galaxies. Should instead we see scatter and stochasticity? I think this is an interesting open question. So my thoughts on where we are as simulators and where we should be going, right? It's clear to me that we're interested in adding more physically motivated feedback. That's why we're here this week, right? We all want to understand what to put into the models and do it in the most precise way possible, most realistic way possible. And you can see that as we've already been using, young star feedback, radiation pressure in winds and photoionization from young stars. But if we're going to constrain these models, right, so the point I was trying to make at the beginning is that we've seen from other speakers this week that you can implement the feedback in different ways in the code, and you can get out the same global star formation rates in the galaxies because you just end up, modulating the feedback until you get regulating the feedback, a star formation until you get the same answer out, basically, with different feedback models. in that case, you know, this is why we all get these really nice global scaling relations. It's why we all match suddenly all these properties of galaxies. If you're just looking at the global properties, it seems like we can match this pretty well these days with simulations, which is a huge advancement, right? This couldn't be said 5 years ago. But if we're going to understand the correct model of feedback, I think there's a couple of ways forward here. The first is understanding the details of the ISM, right? I challenge every simulator in this room to try to get the fraction of H2 correct in a Milky Way mass galaxy. The other thing that you could try to match is the gradients, the chemical gradients. Brad and Gibson had a paper out showing that with stronger feedback, you actually flatten the metallicity gradients in Milky Way mass galaxies. And so you can use chemical gradients as a way of constraining how strong your feedback should be. And of course, I'm not showing it here because Oscar showed really nice on the first day that galactic winds vary as a function of feedback model as well. And so I think these things, the detailed properties of the ISM and the galactic winds, are really going to be the two key observables that will help us constrain what feedback to put into the simulations. And with that, I think I'm basically right at the end of my talk. So I'll just leave it.
I just want to emphasize the point about Sawala's paper of the Eagle local group zooms, that if that's correct, then the stellar mass to halo mass relation of these galaxies is 1 to 2 orders of magnitude higher than in the simulations that the various groups have used to study the cusp core problem. So it may be that even these tiniest dwarfs have enough. I mean, that remains to be seen, but it may be that even those could become cores.
Right. Great point.
So I have maybe a related question, but we've seen a lot of simulations of massive galaxies with violent explosions and winds which are launched and go pretty far out, especially at high redshift. So that's for giant galaxies like the Milky Way or even larger. And on the other hand, we've seen a lot of simulation of dwarf galaxies, which are usually done, not always, but usually done with zoom simulation. Mm-hmm. So you don't really get the evolution of nearby giant galaxies right in the simulation, because you don't simulate them while you're doing the dwarf, right? And so I'm wondering if we're not missing an interaction between these giant winds coming from giant galaxies at high redshift and the physics of dwarf galaxies, and maybe there is a distant interaction that we are missing in our zoom simulation.
Right, yes and no. I don't know how other groups are doing this, but like if you go out and you look at Charlotte's poster, that's outside. She's got 16 galaxies. Not all of those are the central galaxies in a zoomed-in run. She's actually taken the dwarf galaxies that are sitting next to higher res, say, Milky Way galaxies, and included them in that sample. So if there are environmental effects, it should be showing up in those results. And it's not clear to me that it is. It looks like there's a nice trend still as a function of galaxy mass.
Hi. I have two questions regarding these cusp core problems that you actually alluded to. So the first one, how sure are we observationally that these cores really existed? Because as far as I know, if you actually went to Schwarzschild modeling, which is sort of more general and you don't sort of need to evoke any velocity anisotropy here, then the data is still inconclusive as to whether these cores existed or not.
So it depends which observations you're talking about. So if you, from what I'm hearing from you, you're describing dwarf spheroidal observations, right? Where, yes, in fact, various modelers have used the exact same data, all right, the stellar kinematics data from a number of dwarf galaxies, and yes, they all come to wildly different conclusions. Some of them say it's a cusp, some of them say it's a core, some of them say it could be either. Right. In the end, it does seem to be the different analysis techniques do give you different results in the dwarf spheroidals. So those are highly uncertain. If you believe some of these slopes as a function of halo mass trends that I was showing earlier, then you don't really get large cores in galaxies until like 10 to the 7 in stars is formed. In the Milky Way, that would really only be 4 Nx. So you might get smaller cores as you go further down the luminosity function. That's entirely possible. But yes, in the dwarf spheroidals, you're absolutely right, uncertain. If you go on the other end of the field galaxies and look at dwarf irregulars, there the data actually becomes a lot more conclusive, right? And then they're using the rotation curves of galaxies, H alpha, H1. Some people are now They're becoming very high resolution. They're doing detailed modeling of the non-circular motions, et cetera, et cetera. And that is looking very conclusive that field dwarf irregular galaxies have cores.
The second question regarding the galaxy cluster cores that Newman et al. Finds. If those persisted, so maybe this might point to some interesting structure in the cold dark matter sector, like interacting dark matter or so on. But if so, you may then wonder whether the cores that existed on cluster sizes, which are difficult to achieve with baryonic physics, may also exist in dwarfs for the same reason. And then maybe the baryonic physics recipes that provide cores then overdo the cores.
Say that one more time.
So then you basically, if those cores existed because of some dark matter, structure like interacting dark matter, if you then additionally sort of pump out energy, so you may be basically overproduce those cores in those simulations, or
that's not clear, right? So you may have noticed I was not here yesterday. It's because I was at a dark matter meeting at Caltech where these issues came up. I absolutely agree. Self-interacting dark matter would be an excellent candidate to explain the brightest cluster galaxy results. Nobody has yet run a self-interacting dark matter model with baryons. Right, this is not completely true. So I have, my group has, it's not published yet, right? And I was talking to James Bullock's group yesterday, who are also trying to include the effect of self-interacting dark matter and baryons, and they are finding that it may actually get harder to make a core when you have self-interacting dark matter and feedback effects, which is highly counterintuitive, but that looks like to be the way it's going.
Alison, you nicely started with the emphasis that the metallicity and the metallicity relations also play a role. But when you then have shown the strong winds, you've neglected any metallicity. And we have, for instance, shown in the Recchi and Hensler paper last year that these strong winds, for instance, also push out a huge amount of metals so that you cannot achieve the metallicity in dwarf galaxies. Do you have a figure also that shows how the metallicity is?
Yeah, actually, on the poster, Charlotte showed the metallicity in the outflows. All right, so in that same mass.
No, not in the outflows. Oh. That remains in the galaxy itself.
Oh,
that,
that
is then much less than 10% or.
Oh.
We push out 99%, 0.9% or so in these strong winds.
Right.
So they cannot really retain sufficient.
Right. What I know is, I don't have an exact number for you. What I know is on the plot, right, is what's blown out compared to what's left behind, and that's the outflows are about three times more rich than what stays behind. Mm-hmm. But I don't have the actual mass budget in metals. That's a great question.
I have maybe a silly question / comment. You made a point that you were showing these winds, and you made a point that feedback became more efficient when it happened in denser gas, like when it was more concentrated to dense clumps. Wasn't Stephanie making the exact opposite argument the other day? Like feedback became more efficient when it happened in diffuse gas.
Is that how you would interpret that?
If you allowed stars to escape from the dense regions, right?
But I mean, we are at a much higher resolution, so I guess that's a difference here. I don't know if we can really directly compare it at this point.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure what to. I haven't thought about that. I'm not quite sure what to make of that.
It just seems to me that you're relying on sort of opposite things to get the feedback working, and that's a bit confusing.
Yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. I mean, this is part of the reason this is working, right? It's because it's a subgrid model,
sure.
And you know, we're dumping a whole bunch of energy into highly dense peaks, and they become massively overpressurized, which is why we get these winds, right? Whether or not that's the correct way you should be driving these winds is a whole other question.
So what is actually the subgrid recipe that you're using?
Yeah, I just kind of skimmed over that, you mean? Actually, I didn't mention it at all. It is, I mean, I think, okay. So it is based on the blast wave model from Stinson et al. I don't know if you're familiar with this, but as supernovae go off, you actually calculate the radius that should be affected by any given supernovae based on the pressure in the surrounding ISM, and that's deposited as thermal feedback. We do still turn off cooling in this in these simulations, but my point is, you know, compared to other galaxies that do not turn off cooling, we're still getting the same global relations out, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay, I just want to react to that. So, I think. If you turn off the cooling, then you can't really say whether going to higher density makes the feedback more efficient, because if you didn't turn off the cooling rate goes to density square, the energy input rate goes to density to 1.5. So, but I don't think that's, I don't mean it as criticism. I think the reason, what you illustrate is that you need more efficient feedback. Given your subgrid model, you get that by having a higher density threshold. But it's not because you're doing better physics, like cold phase
physics. I didn't say it was.
Because even without that, you could get more efficient feedback by changing your subgrid model, and you get the same result then.
Okay, it's very sad. We will have to cut here. A lot of interesting questions. I hope you will keep them for the discussion. I'm so sorry. So let's thank Alison again. And we break for coffee. We're back at 10 to 4.